Do the lights for me? Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me. I pretty much will promise you that I will stay away from any exotic gauge theories in this talk and talk about real experiments. The work that I'm going to be talking about, it's going to be done in, has been done in collaboration with two of my students, Shashank Misra and Michael Vershinin. And without whom none of this would have been possible. And also it's been a collaboration with Yoichi Ando's group in Japan who provided the samples for these measurements. Now, a number of us here have been interested in the cuprate problem, and there's been a number of discussions about what happens as you dope a mob insulator to try to understand the phase diagram of high temperature superconductors. I think today we're going to hear a number of talks focused on what happens in the underdoped cuprates, where, as you know, as you dope mod insulators, the mod gap disappears, the antiferromagnetic phase is replaced by some exotic state, maybe an exotic state, which we call the pseudo-gap state. And the talks this morning are going to be focused on experiments trying to address what the nature of the electronic states in this part of the phase diagram is. Now, let's just start out with what is considered well established in this field and what is not. So as you dope the cuprates far enough, you get superconductivity. And after many years of work now, we are pretty confident that while we don't have a description of the mechanism of why superconductivity comes about, but a number of different experiments have shown us that we have a D-wave superconductor, and this, at least at optimal doping, at the lowest temperature, a description based on a D-wave state where you have nodes in the superconducting order parameter is by now very well established. And this has come from a number of different experiments, both phase-sensitive experiments and experiments sensitive to the order parameter itself. Now, what is less understood, and it's the focus of my talk, is what happens when you make superconductivity go away, either by raising the temperature or by lowering doping. It seems that you recover a state which is far from that of a simple metal, namely you have a state in which the electronic states at low energies are still partially gapped. So there's been, I don't know how many, thousands of papers have been written about trying to understand this pseudo-gap state. But I'm going to try to review at least some of the ideas that have been put on the table in trying to address its properties. Now, the most useful experimental technique of the pseudo-gap state up to now has been the photoemission experiments, which basically shine light onto the sample, eject electrons, and analyze the energy of the electrons coming out of the sample. Now, when you're inside the superconducting state at very low temperatures, photoemission basically recovers a Fermi surface, if you like, which is consistent with the D-wave superconductor. There are four nodal points, and there are sharp quasi-particles that they can detect in this superconducting state. Now, as they raise the temperature and go above TC, it seems like they do not recover something that looks like a normal metal. They have large portions of the Fermi surface which are still gapped. And this is the phenomenon that we call the pseudo-gap. So the pseudo-gap is associated with not in the entire Fermi surface, if you like, if you were to even call it that, but it's associated with the zone face region of the Biron zone. In addition to that, it seems like what you call as quasi-particles becomes extremely broad as you go into this higher temperature regime, much broader than what you have expected based on just thermal broadening. So this is pretty much what we know about this phase. It's a kind of an incoherent soup of electrons, and we haven't been able to do any other experiments to go beyond this and try to characterize the electronic states in this rather complicated state. One other point that is important to make is the size of this pseudo gap seems to become larger and larger as you reduce the doping in the material, and this is something that is by now pretty well established using a variety of different techniques. So it's a phenomenon that starts out somewhere around optimal doping or maybe beyond, and it keeps rising and it becomes much more stronger as you go more and more under dope. Now, what are the ideas as to the origin of the pseudo gap? From the early days, the study of NMR and spin susceptibility brought out the idea that there might be some sort of a spin pairing going on in the compound. Basically, some of the spin susceptibility is disappearing as you go into the pseudo gap state. And that has been on the table from early days. Now, more recently, people focus on this question, this property that the pseudo gap sort of emerges very smoothly out of the superconducting gap, and perhaps the connection that the pseudo gap may be related to a superconducting gap. And what you have at high temperatures are pairs of electrons, and you have a pairing amplitude, but you lack phase coherence. So it's kind of an incoherent soup of pairs. And there's been a number of different experiments in trying to address whether there is any evidence for pairing above TC. And there are experiments probing the superfluid density at high frequencies. For example, by Joe Ornstein, he has shown evidence in underdope cuprates that there is some evidence for these pairing behavior or superfluid response at high frequency at high temperatures. There are experiments from Puan Ong showing perhaps that there are some evidence for vorticity above TC. Now, the other side of the coin has been that perhaps the pseudo gap is caused by a completely different phenomena, in fact, a competing phenomena, which competes with superconductivity. And there has been a number of experiments that has shown that perhaps there is a tendency for charges in the cuprates to organize, at least in the underdope samples. So the other thing that's been on the table, at least in the underdope samples, has been that there has been a number of different proposals for a variety of different ordering phenomena, charge ordering, spin ordering, orbital ordering. And a number of statements have been made about the connection between these type of ordering phenomena and the pseudo-gap physics. Now, much of what people have tried to do in trying to address these proposals for ordering in underdope cuprates has been to do neutron scattering experiments. And scattering neutrons gives you information about any kind of organization you have in your sample, but it doesn't have the connection, if you like, to the spectroscopic measurement that was performed with photo emission. So in some sense, the connection between getting this real space organization and the pseudo gap phenomena is indirect at best. All right, so that's where we come in. We're going to use a technique which has the ability to see local ordering. In particular, we're going to use a scanning tunneling microscope, which allows us to map electronic states on surfaces. Now, let me just remind you, the way the STM works is that you can bring a sharp tip near the surface until you have a tunneling current. And as you raster the tip across the surface in the imaging mode, you keep the tunneling current constant, and that gives you an image of the contours of constant electron density. Now, in connecting with the photo emission experiments, you can use the STM as a spectroscopic tool, measuring the rate of tunneling as a function of energy, and it's by now very well established that this technique allows you to measure spectroscopic property very accurately. Now, over the years at Illinois, we have established a laboratory with different kind of instrumentation, allowing us to explore a whole different regions of the phase diagram. Today, I'm going to talk about experiments from a particular instrument that was designed to operate at these high temperatures. And as I go along, I'll tell you what the challenge is in these experiments and why it took us about 3 years to build such an instrument. All right, so the plan for this talk is to show you experiments using STM deep in the superconducting state and contrast these measurements to what we see above TC in the pseudo-gap state in underdope sample. And the contrast between these two experiments will hopefully address some of the questions that I have raised throughout this talk. All right, so the experimental system that we're looking at is bismuth strontium calcium copper oxide. This is a very nice system for STM studies because you can easily cleave this material between the bismuth oxide plane in the crystal structure, and this allows you to get clean surfaces, which is crucial for STM studies. Now, the copper oxygen plane is actually beneath the surface, but is well protected in terms of change of doping and whatnot by the bismuth oxide surface. Okay. So when you cleave these samples and put them in the STM, this is a typical STM topograph that you obtain. If you zoom in, what you see are the bismuth atoms, which make the pattern throughout this image. And the copper oxygen plane is 4 angstrom beneath the surface. What you also notice are these features that are running along what's called the B-axis of this crystal. And these structural features are associated with when you put extra oxygen inside this compound to make it superconducting. This is essentially a bulk structural feature of this compound, which persists throughout the sample. And it's something that you pick up when you integrate all the electronic density, and it is not that special in the sense that it's completely due to the reconstruction of the atoms.
What are the black holes there?
Those are presumably missing oxygens or the electronic changes that happens near where you put either missing or extra oxygens into this material.
This only happens after you dope, or?
There are ways in which you can get around it by doping with different material, but in the range of doping that you get, this structural feature is very strong.
But in the parent compound, it's not really.
You can't make BISCO with zero doping. Okay.
Is it stronger in the surface, or is it the same?
No, it's the same throughout the bulk. It's strongest in the bismuth oxide plane. It gets weaker as you go to the copper oxygen plane and gets strong again. It's kind of a modulation. So let's start with the spectroscopic property measured on this bismuth oxide surface. You measure the rate of tunneling as a function of energy, and you get a curve that looks like this. And this can closely resemble, if you like, a density of states of a D-wave superconductor, which has been averaged around the Fermi surface.
Well, I can't really, in the following sense, when I look at your yellow curve there.
Yeah, you stole the words out of my mouth. So I think, you know, you can look at this curve and compare it to there and sort of be maybe satisfied with the fit or not. But what I'd like to show you is actually other kinds of experiments that can show you that you really have a D-wave superconductor. Because these spectroscopic properties can be modified by, for example, tunneling matrix elements and things that has not been included if you average around the Fermi surface.
Not the D-wave part. Yes, the tremendous peak.
The coherent. Yeah, these peaks are typically much larger.
Yeah. Singular.
They're much more singular than what you have in the D-wave. It's true. So what evidence do we really have in this measurement that you have a D-wave superconductor? And I think the nice evidence comes in when you take a D-wave superconductor and cut it in such a way that the quasi-particle experience the pi phase shift, which is internal to a D-wave superconductor. This is something that's been explored in tunneling experiments on surfaces that cut the D-wave superconductor along a particular direction. And the quasi-particles that scatter from these surfaces basically see a potential where the order parameter is going between plus and minus, and this has a zero-energy solution if you have a D-wave superconductor. And this is, in fact, something that we can realize in our experiment. We can look for edges, step edges, which are oriented along the 110 direction, which cut the copper-oxygen plane at a 45-degree angle. And this is something that can come up in experiments. So here's an example of a cleave of a crystal. Actually, this turns out to be a thin film, but it shows a region of the sample where you have the bismuth oxide plane on this side, you have another plane down below, and if you do the spectroscopic measurement, as you come up to this step, you realize that the peaks associated with the superconductivity die off, and then right at the edge, you have a peak which is right at zero energy. Now, if you track the density of states along this edge, you see that there is a peak that persists over many, many angstroms right around the edge. It turns out that this is exactly the same situation I was telling you about, namely, we have cut a D-wave superconductor along this 110 direction, and the presence of this peak is consistent with having this experiencing this pi phase shift of the superconducting order parameter.
For those of us who are ignorant, can you remind us what the corresponding S-wave superconductor spectra look like?
S-wave.
Right.
As you go near a defect, you would basically superconductivity will slowly suppress, but you would not get any peak there. Okay.
We have a negative result if you have an edge. Yes. Oriented differently.
Yes. Okay. And I'll show you some negative results having to do with what happens when you raise the temperature. Okay. No, we do not. Well, we can discuss that after. Okay. Now let's switch gears and talk about how this spectra changes as you take a region far away from steps and ask the question how the electronic states in a D-wave superconductor are changing locally. So to address that, what we can do is we can take this is a topograph area of the sample, and you can measure this tunneling spectra at every pixel as you move your tip along, and at every pixel, you can record the conductance at a particular energy, and you can get a map of what the electronic states look like at a specific energy. So here's a topograph of this particular region of the sample. Here's what electronic states look like at 72 millivolts. You kind of see a small but varying background where the electronic states are inhomogeneous throughout the sample. And as you change the energy, you see a number of things happening. This inhomogeneous background changes its character. There are some modulations there that I'll focus on in a minute. And then as you go to very low energies, what you see are the defects that are present inside these superconductors. So these are specifically zinc defects and vacancies, which show up as very bright features in the density of states when you probe the system at very low energies. Now, a great deal has been made of this electronic modulation or variation on these bismuth, strontium, calcium, copper oxide samples. And the thing to keep in mind is that these are samples in which the doping is inhomogeneous. So for example, one way in which you can characterize this electronic variation is you can look at the variation of the gap parameter, or 2 delta, as a function of position, and you can make maps of what the gap looks like at every location as you move along the surface. And this will show you some inhomogeneous variation of the gap, which can be quite large, but the variation, the standard deviation variation is about 20%. So this variation, we believe, is essentially due to the dopant fluctuation that happens inside this compound. Okay? Now, there is another feature in the maps of the electronic state of a D-wave superconductor that comes out. If you were paying close attention, you will see that as I go through these maps, at low energies, around the energies of the gap, you start to see this background pattern that's coming everywhere throughout the field of view. In the background, okay? You see this pattern running in both directions. Now, to analyze that information more carefully, what you can do is you can take this electronic states maps and Fourier transform them and look at all the different wavelengths that are involved in the problem. So this is still in the superconducting state, and here's what it is at 72 millivolts. What you can see are the structural features. These are where the atomic lattice comes in. These are the supermodulation that I showed you in real space. And as you vary the energy and you go to low energies, you start seeing other features corresponding to modulations running along the copper-oxygen bond direction that come in and move around in this Fourier space, which show you that there is a modulation which is, as you change the energy, it changes its character as you look at these maps at different energies. So let me quantify that a little bit better. So what we have are these maps of the electronic wave function at different energies, and we can take cuts through them, focusing on these modulations that are running along the copper-oxygen bond directions. And these modulations will show up as these peaks in these cuts that we take through this Fourier space. And we can track these modulations as a function of energy. So in the superconducting state, we see bond-oriented modulations that change the wavelength as you change the energy of the electrons. Now, it turns out, those of you who followed this field, these modulations were actually first seen by the Stanford and Berkeley group doing STM on the same surfaces. And here is basically our measurements in red contrasting to their measurements. So there are these patterns, electronic modulations in real space in the superconducting state, which change the wavelength as you change the electron energy. What are these caused by? It turns out that majority of what we see, which causes these patterns, is really nothing more than what happens if you take the Fermi surface of this superconductor and consider what happens to electrons as they scatter around this Fermi surface, running into defects. This has been a proposal that's been put forward by Donghai Li, that if you consider this D-wave superconductor and look at the constant electron energy surfaces, at the very end of these surfaces have shapes of shapes that are like a banana, like these different bananas that are plotted here. And at the very ends of bananas, you have these large electronic densities, and scattering between them would give you an interference pattern, very much like you get interference pattern on the electron scattering off of defects in a normal metal. So, to repeat that, basically you have a D-wave superconductor, and if you look at different electrons at different energies on this Fermi surface, they have these contours, and they can scatter between these contours, giving you an interference pattern, which its wavelength would change as you change the electron energy. So there is, in some sense, so here's what is shown is our data, and this is the black line is what you get if you take the photo emission characterization of the Fermi surface of this compound and scatter electrons around it, and you get an agreement or a disagreement depending on your point of view. So this has been kind of an ongoing debate in this field, which is that some people look at this curve and say, well, just taking in account the band structure, we can pretty much explain why there are these modulations in the material and why they disperse as a function of energy. But there are those who looked at this picture and they say, no, look, there is a deviation from this band structure explanation of these modulation, and perhaps that's indicative of some other phenomena that's going on in the sample. So I'm going to be a bit unfair to those people and say that pretty much in the superconducting state, if you take all of the data that we have, if you take the D-wave order parameter, put in the band structure, and throw in a bit of dopant inhomogeneity, we can pretty much understand most of what we see in these nanoscale experiments. Yes?
Is the intensity of modulation change across that period
as you move in energy? Yeah, it changes and it follows the density of states.
Well, once the theory and experiment start deviating from each other, is there a change in the intensity?
The size of the signal in the superconducting state at those energies where it deviates is very small. So it's very hard to quantify that the deviation is significant at that particular energy. But the size of the modulation basically follows the density of states being largest right at where you have the peak in the density of states.
When Seamus Davis presents this data, he extracts Fermi surface directly, and then he states that it's an excellent agreement with photo emission. So I would like to understand where the discrepancy comes in. Is it?
I don't know why I can't go backwards. There is the same, you can extract or you can compare. So I've compared. So,
this is the same data and the same model.
Same model. This is their data, that's our. No, it doesn't, I mean, it's just, you can plot this in a number of different ways which can exaggerate or not exaggerate small differences.
It's nice of the beholder, right? What he's calling excellent agreement, you are saying not, you know, somebody else could say agreement is not that excellent.
I'm trying to be honest, yeah.
I have a question. Suppose one were doing tunneling measurements, STM measurements on some totally different non-exotic, you know, silicon.
Okay.
How will that agree band structure? I think they don't agree completely either, right?
Yes. Yeah, on copper, it agrees reasonably well, but it's not perfect. Okay. But I'm being told that I have very short time here, so now I'm going to try to get to the most interesting part of this talk. So I've told you about what I considered what sort of well understood mostly. Okay, so we're leaving the superconducting state. We're going to go to the pseudo gap state, where we have the tunneling density of states showing us that there is a pseudo gap. Now let me just remind you. As far as photoemitters tell us, the presence of quasi-particles is disappearing as you go above TC in these underdoped samples. And it's something that happens pretty dramatically. This is a characterization of the size of this peak as a function of temperature. It's something that happens pretty dramatically as you approach the bulk TC. So we're going to be doing experiments that are at 20 degrees above TC. So we are really deep into this this pseudo gap state and far away from what I will call the knees of this fluctuating superconductor. Okay, so here are measurements on samples which have TC of 80 Kelvin. We are doing measurements on 100 Kelvin. And let me first show you the tunneling spectra and tell you quickly that if you measure this tunneling spectra as a function of position, you pretty much end up with the same kind of variation in the tunneling in the size of the pseudo gap as we saw in the variation in the superconducting gap. Okay, so in some sense, this doesn't surprise me because you have this dopant inhomogeneity, which again is going to modify the pseudo gap in the same way that it might modify the superconducting gap. All right. Now, the first experiment that we can talk about is, are there any evidence that there is some sort of a local coherence in this superconducting state? At least one of the ideas that's been on the table is that, you know, the pseudo-gap state has some local coherence, but you haven't established superconductivity on long length scale. Maybe we are dealing with something that looks like almost like a granular superconductor. So the first experiment I'm going to show you is, again, the EDGE experiment, where we look at, on very short length scales, with the STM, and if in these small regions you have a D-wave superconductor, you might expect that there is some sort of Andreev state bound to the edge of the superconductor, very much like I showed you in the superconducting state. So quickly, let me show you that the answer to that question is no. At 100 Kelvin in these samples, looking at the density of states as you approach an edge, which is again running along the 110 direction, shows that you know, the density of states gets modified. There are some details in there that I'm not going to get into, but there are no huge sharp peak that's coming in showing us that there is some sort of a bound state to the step edge. So in some sense, it looks as if I don't know exactly how we're going to think about this experiment, but over some length scale that is being probed at 100 Kelvin, we can't really say that there is any kind of local superconductivity in the sample.
See when this bound state appears?
We are tracking it now as a function of temperature, and it looks like it may do exactly what you see in photo emission, namely it comes on at TC. All right. Now, so it doesn't look like it's a locally coherent state, this incoherent soup, and now we're going to ask the simplest question of all, namely what's so special about electronic states at these low energies which show the pseudo gap versus electronic states at higher energies. So let me remind you that when we take topography, again, integrate the density of states, and to show you what happens at the specific energy, I'm going to show you the conductance maps, very much like what I showed you in the superconducting state. So here's what the conductance map looks like out for energies outside the pseudo gap. So this is a look at electronic wave function at 41 millivolts. You see on fine scale something resembling atoms. There is something running along this direction, which is along B-axis. But there is not a whole lot of variation that you see in the electronic state, except what you see that may be associated with doping variation in the sample. Now watch what happens as I start lowering the energy. And you have a question? This is a differential conductor. Yeah, so this is the density of states. Yeah. Okay. So now I'm going to start lowering the energy, and I'm going to start probing what electrons look like as you go inside the pseudo-gap energy scale. And as you go down to those energies, here's in the middle of the pseudo-gap at 18 millivolt, you start to see another pattern emerge from the data. Okay? I'll have to talk fast. Okay, so let me back up. At 40 millivolts, you had sort of not much of a pattern. Now, as you start lowering the energy, you go 18, 12 millivolts, you can clearly see there is a modulation that is running along the a 45 degree direction relative to the B axis, which would be along the copper oxygen bond directions. And this modulation seems to persist all the way down to the Fermi energy, where we can probe the system in the pseudo gap state right at zero energy. So the first point to make, which comes out of the raw data, is that if you just compare these maps above the pseudo-gap energy scale versus below, there is a pattern there in the low energy states, which is not there at higher energies. And this pattern seems to, it's not a sharp boundary, but it seems to correlate as you probe the states at these low energies. Now, what's the size of this effect? As you can see from this curve, the size of the pseudo-gap is about 20% suppression of the density of states at this particular temperature. Okay? Now, if I took a cut through this data and looked at how the electronic states were modulating in real space, it turns out that the modulation is also about 20% at zero energy. So there seems to be, the two effects are of the same order. Okay? Whatever states you're losing out due to pseudo-gap formation of the pseudo-gap seems to correspond to whatever electronic states are modulating in real space into this pattern. Now, to characterize these patterns more carefully, what we do is we again take large area maps of the electronic states and we perform Fourier transform on these maps. And again, we can see the atomic lattice, we can see the superstructure, and we can again see bond-oriented modulation running along the copper-oxygen bonds. Now, here's what the electronic states look like right at the Fermi energy. Again, you have these modulations. Now, here comes the big important distinction between what we see in the superconducting state as compared to the pseudo-gap state. So in the pseudo-gap states, if you look at these maps at different energies, you find that the electronic modulations, which correspond to modulating at a wavelength, which is, in this sample, about 4.7 copper-copper distance, do not disperse as you vary the electronic energy. So as you map states at different energy in the superconducting state, we saw modulations that change their wavelength. But if you do this in the pseudo-gap state, they seem to be fixed. Now, a couple of points. This number is obviously incommensurate with the lattice, okay? And we are now doing experiments where we see that this number actually moves systematically as you vary doping. And the results on that are still yet to come out.
As you underdope, it gets longer?
As you underdope, it gets closer to 4. Yeah. We haven't done that carefully enough, but that's a good question. I just want to make a note about this error bar. This is the error bar for taking this point and moving it by a whole pixel, which is enormous in terms of error. We can find the position of the peak much better than a pixel. So our error bars in terms of this statement that the modulation do not disperse as a function of energy is more precise than even this number. This is very conservative. Now, let me tell you something about the coherence length of these modulations, namely the width associated with these curves. These modulations seem to be coherent over a very short length scale of only about 80 angstroms, okay? Okay, so now if you're a skeptic, you will say, well, these modulations in these maps, atomic, superstructure, whatnot, they all look about the same, you know? If you're trying to say that there is something special about these peaks happening at point Q, how are those peaks different than the structural feature of the material? So remember I told you that we cannot detect these modulations at high energies. We only detect them below the pseudo-gap energy scale. And what we see is that the intensity of the modulation rises as you go to lower and lower energies. Now, if you ask the same question for the structural feature in the material, the modulations corresponding to structural features are going down as you lower the energy. Now, I think I can understand this behavior very well. Remember that there is a pseudo gap in the tunneling density of states. There are less electrons available for tunneling at lower energies. And these modulations corresponding to the atomic and the superstructure would correspond to how many electrons you have available there for tunneling. So the dying off of these electronic features, the atomic and the superstructure features, is not that surprising. But it's very surprising that these modulation that we observe around the pseudo-gap energy scale seems to take its lion's share of the electronic intensity as you go to lower and lower energy. That's rather surprising. Okay, so let me summarize what I've told you. There is a big difference between modulations we observe in the superconducting state and the pseudo-gap state. The modulation in the superconducting states can be very weak. Okay, in the pseudo-gap state, these modulations seem to correspond to about 20% variation, let's say, at the Fermi energy. Okay, and we can detect them over a wide range of energies, and over this whole range, they do not seem to change their wavelength. And they seem to be incommensurate, and there is doping, and there may be even temperature dependent to the wavelength, that those are things that remains to be worked out. So what are these modulations due to? Okay, so the first thing we want to throw out is that there is some sort of an interference phenomenon very similar to what I showed you in the superconducting state causing these standing wave patterns. I'm going to go through this very quickly because the modulations don't change their wavelength as a function of energy. If you have any kind of interference phenomena, as you can go and calculate, these are calculations from a variety of different models. You see modulations that change their wavelength as a function of energy. And the error bars on the experiments are fairly tight in terms of showing that the modulation doesn't disperse. So I think any kind of interference phenomena would be very difficult to explain as it sort of exceeds any kind of error bar that we have put on the experiment. Okay? So I think this quantum interference as a possibility for these modulations is a very weak possibility. I even discussed lattice effects because, as I showed you, it behaves completely different from what you observe, from what the structural features of the material do. Okay, so that leaves the possibility that maybe what we are seeing is some sort of an ordering phenomena. Okay, unfortunately, there are a number of brands on the market that you can buy in terms of what type of ordering can happen in underdoped cuprates. The first one is the possibility that you have some sort of a spin density wave that happens in underdoped cuprates. As you know, in neutron scattering, the pi-pi resonance gets replaced by incommensurate structures showing that there is some sort of a spin texture in the material. With the exception of one material, which is the neodymium doped LASCO, these neutron peaks seem to disperse as a function of energy. Now, if you were going to propose that electron scattering off of this spin structure is giving rise to what we see in the STM experiment, that's a likely possibility. For example, there are calculations that would show that if you have some sort of a spin collective mode scattering off of it, you would see it in STM measurement. It would be reflected in the charge density, except you would show the same dispersion that the spin collective mode is displaying in the STM measurements. And these set of models would not have nothing to say about why what we observe correlates with the energy scale of the pseudo-gap. Charge ordering is a possibility. There's been a number of ideas out there, and there are more accumulating with the notion that has been proposed from the early days that the competition between the Coulomb and magnetic force on the electrons can give rise to the separation and patterns of holes can be created in these materials. What can the data say about these possibilities? Well, it gives you the constraint that whatever we've got going on is probably inherently two-dimensional. Okay, it's not a 1D structure unless you maybe propose some sort of a fluctuating one-dimensional behavior. And there are lots of ideas whether you have bond ordering or site ordering, but whatever we have to have at the end of the day appears to be something that is inherently two-dimensional. It also needs to be consistent with doping of the material, namely as you change the doping, things have to change. Okay? Now, along these ideas, one question that has come up is this notion that this experimental observation, that we seem to correlate the observation of this pattern with the pseudo-gap energy scale. Remember way back, I throw out the idea that, well, maybe the energy scale of the pseudo-gap has something to do with the pairing in the material. And in response to some of these experiments, there's been a number of ideas that have been proposed that perhaps pairs are formed in the material, but they are localized in space, and they give some sort of organization in real space. The number of people are proposing ideas similar to this. Okay, I am pretty much out of town. Okay, so let me just throw this out. This is a work that has been done in collaboration with Su Chang Zhang, which is it's a toy model, which looks at if you did have such a structure in which pairs are organized in real space, what is the ability of the STM to distinguish between a charge ordering and sort of pairs ordering? And it turns out that it's a sort of an obvious idea, namely as you go to low energies, you become sensitive to seeing the pair modulations. And if you do a calculation, you can at least make an explanation of the fact that why this modulation rises as you go to lower and lower energies. Now, I'm going to finish off by telling you what we're doing with these patterns. Right now, we're looking at some bizarre properties of these patterns. Namely, if you map the electronic states on the electron side of these patterns and compare them to what the hole-like pattern would be, basically flipping the STM bias, you find that these modulations have sort of the same registry. Okay, and this is something we are trying to nail down very carefully, but it looks like that there is some sort of a approximate electron hole symmetry having to do with these where these modulations are. And if this holds up, this is going to constrain the various models. So this is my last slide. And so what have I told you? I contrasted experiments in the superconducting state with the pseudo-gap state. And we are basically showing evidence that the electronic states up here seem to give rise to some sort of an organization in real space, which is characterized by a square pattern in which electrons run along the copper-oxygen bond directions. Now, it turns out that if you look at experiments that were done in the past, one experiment in particular probes electrons deep in the superconducting state and shows that near vortices, you have a tunneling spectra which resembles that of the pseudo-gap state. And in the vicinity of vortices, you seem to observe immodulation in real space, which corresponds very much to modulations we see everywhere throughout the pseudo-gap state. And there is now a recent experiment by a number of people probing the copper oxychlorides, looking at very underdoped cuprates, again, out in the vicinity of sort of outside or near the superconducting transition, but at much lower temperatures. And there also, these modulations corresponding to four lattice constants seem to be very prominently observed. So the conclusion could be that these number of experiments are telling us that there is a competing state, that there is a density wave that competes with superconductivity that can form out here whenever you have killed superconductivity, either by presence of vortices or raising the temperature or going to extreme underdoping. So with that, I stop and take your questions.
With respect to the last data you showed us where you put on a magnetic field and you suppress the superconductivity, I remember...
This is the Hoffman et al.
Hoffman et al.
Yeah.
If I remember, the neutron scattering would give us an indication that there was a pi phase shift of some kind, because the antiferromagnetism would be on a scale of roughly 8 A0,
mm-hmm.
while the CDW is 4 A0. So my question would be...
Well, those are experiments done in different compounds, but if you make that connection, yes.
Ah, so it's different enough that we can't make that direct connection.
Well, that connection has been made throughout this field, which is that neutron scattering in underdoped cuprates seems to see structure of 8, and that sometimes they see even evidence for charge ordering.
But maybe my point would be, it would be very interesting on the materials you're showing us now, where you see the pattern, if we only knew what the neutrons were doing, if we could. And the reason would be, it seems to me that when you show the checkerboard pattern
mm-hmm.
with the pair density
mm-hmm.
of the one you just showed us, the typical
there would be
back-
no, the spin background is not consistent. That's
yes.
a good, that's a, no. I'm sorry? There are no new, yeah, there, well, your point being that there is no neutron evidence.
Right. Ali, we should say it could be made consistent, but it's not yet made in Zhang's calculation. They haven't put in the necessary extra magnetic interactions that could force it.
Right. I mean,
and
there are numbers.
You never see that in the DMRG calculation. So
right.
I think if we knew that background and we knew whether the neutron, if we could see it, what the neutron spin background is telling you, you
right.
could distinguish between the last model you told us about.
Well, the one thing we can do, which is to do different STM experiments that will constrain in terms of what the patterns look like as a function of electrons and holes, that will put extra constraint on the variety of these models. But I agree with you that the spin background in that model may not be consistent.
I had a couple questions about your data from the pseudogap phase. And the first is, if you go in an early transparency,
mm-hmm.
you showed the differential conductance, a mm-hmm. typical curve from that, and then you were saying that the modulation was about 20%. Is it easy to... yeah, something like that. I guess what I was curious is that as you go spatially in different parts where it goes up and down,
mm-hmm.
does this whole curve go up and down, or are there some places where it's just flat and you don't see this dip?
Okay, so there's one thing you have to be careful about how STM works, which is that when you move the tip from place to place, you're keeping the you do this under servo, which keeps the total tunneling density of
mm-hmm.
state constant. Okay? So the whole curve, here's what the...
Mm-hmm.
Under that condition, when you move the tip, the density of state's background is not going up and down because you ask the STM
mm-hmm.
to follow the trajectory to keep the total constant.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I just said? So there, but if you plot what the intensity is doing in the conductance map, there is a variation. So the spectra itself, taken at every location, could look the same, because you've taken out the modulation when you look at the conductance map allows you to look at the specific energy in such a way that you can take out the canceling of the density of states that you have done with the STM. We can discuss this more in detail, but this experiment done at every location can take out, if you look at the whole curve, it can take out the background modulation.
What I was asking is, I don't exactly understand the experiment that was done in the graph there, but if you did that in different places, would you always see the dip, is the question I'm
asking. Yeah, you always see the dip.
Okay.
And here's the data.
And the second question that I wanted to ask was related to the question of whether there's some kind of stripe order that would be fluctuating and how you could distinguish that experimentally.
Well,
I guess if you have a modulation of some kind of ordered pattern, you would normally expect if you have an ordering vector, say at Q, which is in the pi zero direction, and Qx and Qy in the orthogonal direction, you'd expect to see another peak at Qx plus Q pi plus Qy. Whereas if you had a fluctuating, sometimes one dimensional this way and sometimes one dimensional that way, you'd only expect to see a series of peaks off in the x direction and off in the y direction when you Fourier transformed it.
Mm-hmm. The experiment is essentially DC, okay? So if there is any, if you have patterns in real space, that...
No, I understand that. The question is it's analogous to if you're doing crystallography, for example, and you have a twin sample, you'll see a superposition of the diffraction...
So the question is, what would be the size of those domains that would be running in different directions? That would be the first question. So if you look at the real space map, you'd be hard-pressed to define that. Okay? So, if you look at this pattern, or you look at the FFT, you know, you basically can convince yourself that what you're seeing is due to the overlapping lines.
I guess the only question I was asking was an experimental question about whether you see, is your data consistent with a purely sinusoidal modulation? You don't see any other peaks?
We don't see any other peaks. I mean, basically, you can do the FFT and you just see one component which is symmetric along the two different orientations. So if you have any kind of domaining going on in the sample, where you have part of the, you know, because you're looking at the small area, you would expect two of the peaks to be brighter than the other two. And whenever we observe that, that seems to correlate with an anisotropy, for example, in the tip of the STM, which also shows up in the atomic peaks. Okay, so there seems to be very little evidence for an anisotropic pattern.
Yeah, so in the data you have three features. One is the modulation vector is constant. And the second thing is it only shows up within the pseudo gap. And the third thing is that it seems to have some strange approximate particle symmetry. And since the sample is actually inhomogeneous, I'm wondering that whether this can be just simply explained by the mid-gap state of these local impurities. Because if you really just work out the whole thing, I mean, this is actually not that correct to call it approximate particle symmetry. It's nothing but the approximate Dirac symmetries in the Bogoliubov-Degen equation if you solve the mid-gap states.
This is not a superconductor.
Yeah, it's true, but... Okay.
A last question, a short one, please.
I wanted to ask two.
When you do this comparison of dispersion peaks with the band structure, so it seems to work well at high energies and bad at low energies. Actually,
yes.
We showed, and you know, that if you take disordered charge density waves, that's exactly what you get. Do you have any good reason for why you don't accept this?
I think your point is that if you put in this a sort of ordering phenomena superimposed on the quasi-particles.
No, it's different. It's just a disordered charge density, which does not have a fixed period.
Yes.
It's just random.
Well, I think it's all in the eye of the beholder, right? I mean, if you look at this curve, you can say it's good, or no, you know, I think this deviation is significant. And your work would say, well, look, the deviation is significant. And this is indicative of some sort of ordering persisting in this state. It's hard, you know, experimentally you need a way to distinguish that further. In the pseudo-gap state, the distinction seems to be far enough from the error bars of the experiment that this curve misses the data by six times the experimental error. So I have no trouble saying that what we are observing is some sort of ordering phenomena. But here, it's trickier.
The low energy part is clearly different than the high energy part.
Okay, thank you. Since we only have 10 minutes here for the break, I think we should stop here and thank the speaker again.
Thank you.
And please...